When my babies went through their exploration stage, I had so much to worry about. Falling over, bumping heads. What did she just put in her mouth? The list was endless. But when they were in Pampers Swaddlers, I knew I never had to worry about a leaky diaper. Swaddlers are great for both baby and mommy. They keep your baby's skin healthy and dry with Pampers Breathe Free Liner, which wicks away wetness, allowing your baby's skin to breathe. Swaddlers have always given me peace of mind knowing that diaper rash and leaky diapers were not in our future. There's also the new blowout barrier at the back waist to help prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Pampers Swaddlers are dermatologist approved by the Skin Health Alliance, hypoallergenic and free of parabens and latex. Your baby deserves that. And they're available in a wide range of sizes from newborn to size 8, and now feature designs with the newest animal characters, Shiloh the elephant and Freddy the duck. Having a diaper you can depend on is important, and is why I have always loved Pampers, the number one pediatrician-recommended brand. Download the Pampers Club app today to start earning rewards with every diapers and wipes purchase. Not to mention, you can get great parenting content with Pampers Club. Carmen Maria Machado's new memoir, In the Dream House, is as beautiful as it is haunting. By telling the story of an abusive relationship between Machado and another woman, it offers a compelling meditation on desire, power, wanting to be wanted, and the complexity of who gets cast as a villain. Carmen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I could not put In the Dream House down. It is incredible. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I loved it. You are obviously a very gifted storyteller. You and I, both Cuban, more specifically, both have Cuban fathers. Cubans are storytellers.
They are.
Tell me about an early memory you have of learning or experiencing the power of storytelling. Who in your life was a good storyteller?
Oh, my grandfather, my dad's father, he actually passed away this year, so I've been thinking about him. You know, he had dementia, and at the end, there was something really hard about that person who was so, like, alive and so, and would tell stories, and, you know, to see that person sort of diminished in that way towards the end of his life was, like, very difficult. But when I was a kid, my grandfather was, like, the most exciting person in the whole world. I mean, he would tell really great stories about Cuba and about, you know, coming to the United States. So there was this giant ceramic St. Bernard statue in their house who they called Bruno. And what he said to me one time was he explained that he was walked past a store and he saw it for sale and he bought it. And then he got a little cart to put it on and put like a leash around its neck. And then he called my grandmother to come pick him up. And so as she was like driving up, she saw him standing with this like what looked like, you know, a giant dog like sitting down next to him. And she really did not like dogs and was very upset. And then when she got closer, realized that it was just this bit, you know, he was just doing a bit. And it's funny because now my sister has that very, very battered Bruno, the ceramic St. Bernard in her home. So, yeah, my grandfather was always like telling stories about his childhood, doing bits, like, you know, he had this just like narrative energy to him that I sort of took for granted in a way. Like, I didn't really realize that that wasn't how everybody was for a long time. I miss him a lot.
So my Cuban grandmother had dementia at the end of her life, and dementia is hard, period. But I think it's also extra hard when that person is your last bridge back to a place that you don't otherwise have a connection to.
Yeah. My brother and I went to Cuba a couple years ago, and I remember coming back and trying to talk to my grandfather about it. And he was better. You know, he wasn't as bad as he was before he died, but he was sort of in the beginning of dementia, and I would sort of, you know, try to talk to him about, like, you know, we saw your house, Granddaddy. Like, we saw the square in Santa Clara. Like, we saw, you know, your school. We saw this and that. But he don't think he quite registered exactly what was sort of happening. And it's strange because, like, for some reason, it's such a strong part of my identity. I think because I had such a strong relationship with my grandfather and he embodied this part of himself and this history and this country where until a few years ago I had never been so powerfully and so strongly that I don't know, it just always felt like very like a connection that I had.
When was your first inkling that you were a storyteller?
Oh God. I just think I was one of those kids that had like a narrative instinct. I mean, kids play, you know, kids create story kind of instinctively. You know, I had very elaborate narratives with my Barbies and my dinosaurs and my, you know, stuffed animals. And I remember one time a babysitter catching me making my dolls talk, and then I got very embarrassed. But yeah, I mean, I read voraciously. I wrote constantly told stories to myself.
No, I love the image of you writing to the head of Scholastic because you found their address in the Babysitter's Club book and submitting your first chapter.
Yeah, some teacher taught me, like, writing a letter, and that was like giving me the keys to the kingdom.
Yes.
I know, I was like,
nobody ever wrote back.
I was like, you can write a letter to literally anyone if you have their address.
I'm still waiting for Anna Martin to send me to respond to my letter.
Well, I wrote, they explained to me, they were like, you know, all publishers, like, their address is in the front of the book, and I was like, what? And like, the only author who ever responded was, I don't know if you remember Olivia Bitten Jackson. Mm-mm. She's written a lot of books for young people about the Holocaust, and she'd written this book called I Have Lived 1,000 Years. She talks about how she had this book of poems that she had written, and when the book was over, I was extremely concerned that she never mentioned in the book that she'd recovered her poems that were lost. And I was very upset about this. And so I wrote her a letter, care of her publisher, like my teacher had shown me. And then maybe like a month later, my mother came in and she said, there's a letter for you from Israel, like in the mailbox.
Amazing.
And she had written back and she's like, my publisher forwarded your wonderful letter to me. Like, thank you so much for writing. And, you know, to answer your question, no, I didn't. I never did get the poems back. And it was like someone reached back.
You write, I didn't date when most people dated. When other teenagers were figuring out what good and bad relationships looked like, I was busy being extremely weird, praying a lot, getting obsessed with sexual purity. So you walk us through that experience and an emotional affair you have with a member of the church. But have you figured out the origin story for how you ended up there?
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny because I mean, like, I feel like I've talked through so much of this in, like, in therapy, you know, being like, yeah, what is this? Where did this come from? I mean, I think I really wanted to be loved. I think I wanted to be admired, and I wanted to be the center of someone's world. Mm. And I wanted to feel good, and I wanted to have sex, you know. I wanted to feel desired and wanted, and had all those sort of normal, like, sort of, you're a teen, and you're, like, figuring out your body, and you're figuring out what you want, and...
But why the obsession with sexual purity? What had brought you there?
I mean, I experienced sexual violence as, like, a young person. And I think the way that my brain sort of processed that was the thing you did wrong was you wanted this thing. Like, you wanted something sexual. And I had this really good friend, and we were both in church together. And we just got really, really fixated on... There was this book that we read called And the Bride Wore White. It was just all about, like, purity for young people. And that idea just became very, like, central to, like, you know, this way of disciplining the self and very neatly sort of fit in with, like, I sort of had fallen in with this gang of evangelicals in my school. And, yeah, and it just sort of, everything sort of came together in this way, you know. And I was like, this is the thing that I need to sort of keep myself safe and protect myself.
The woman you write about in The Dream House... First relationship you have with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Did you identify as queer before that?
I did. You know, it's funny because when I was in high school, there was one girl in particular that I really wanted to kiss all the time. She was like a really good friend. And I didn't understand what that meant. I guess I thought, like, oh, it's just normal to want to kiss your friend. You know, because I knew I liked boys. But I also, like, would think about kissing this person, but, like, couldn't, like, connect the dots exactly. And so I got to college, and I actually had this really dear, dear friend, Anne, who rolled into college, like, identifying as bisexual, being her total self. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's what I am. Like, I remember just having this, like, sense of clarity where I was like, oh, it all makes sense to me now. And then I was like, now everything will be fine because I figured it out, you know, but, like, not having yet processed, like, you have a lot of insecurities about your body and, like, you know.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Because this deeply resonated with me. I just want you to read this entire section for me.
Oh, yeah. Dream House as luck of the draw. Part of the problem was, as a weird fat girl, you felt lucky. She did what you'd wished a million others had done, looked past arbitrary markers of social currency, and seen your brain and ferocious talent and quick wit and pugnacious approach to assholes. Now, when you started writing about fatness a long time ago in your live journal, a commenter said to you that you were pretty and smart and charming, but as long as you were Zoftig, you'd never have your choice of lovers. You remember feeling outrage and then processing the reality, the practicality of what he'd said. You were so angry at the world. You wondered when she came along if this was what most people got to experience in their lives, a straight line from want to satisfaction, desire manifested and satisfied in reasonable succession. This had never been the case before. It had always been fraught. How many times had you said, if I just looked a little different, I'd be drowning in love. Now you got to drown without needing to change a single cell. Lucky you.
A straight line from want to satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
What did her attraction do for your self-esteem?
I mean, I felt really good. I think I feel the way you always feel when somebody's like, I want you, where you're like, oh, me? Wow, okay. Because she was so, like, I was like, she's so hot. I'm so confused. I don't understand.
I just look back at my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the amount of time I spent trying to sell myself with almost no regard for whether or not I wanted to buy.
Yeah.
That I was like, oh, you like hiking? I could learn to like hiking.
Yeah.
As opposed to be like, I don't like hiking. I'm never going to like hiking. Like, let me just stand in this truth and be who I am. And then you can decide whether or not you want that. But that wanting to be wanted became its own exercise.
Of course. Yeah. When I think about being in my 20s and didn't have sex and start dating until I was like 20, 21. I had the same way where I was sort of just like, oh, like, if that's what you want, that's what I can do. Yeah. And I think for her, and I remember thinking like, this is what I've been waiting for the whole time, has been this person and this experience and, you know, somebody who wants me in this way and isn't saying to me like, you need to be different somehow. Because in the beginning, this wasn't, you know, she was just like, you're perfect, you're smart, you're gorgeous, you're hot, you're sexy, like, this is all I want. And I was like, okay, here I am. Here I am, you know.
When my babies were going through their exploration stage, I had so much to worry about. Falling over, bumping heads, what did she just put in her mouth? The list was endless. But when they were in Pampers Swaddlers, I knew I never had to worry about a leaky diaper. Swaddlers are great for both baby and mommy. They keep your baby's skin healthy and dry with Pampers Breathe Free Liner, which wicks away wetness, allowing your baby's skin to breathe. Swaddlers have always given me peace of mind knowing that diaper rash and leaky diapers were not in our future. There's also the blowout barrier at the back waist to help prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Pampers Swaddlers are dermatologist approved by the Skin Health Alliance, hypoallergenic and free of parabens and latex. Your baby deserves that. And they're available in a wide range of sizes from newborn to size 8. And now feature designs with the newest animal characters, Shiloh the elephant and Freddy the duck. Having a diaper you can depend on is important. And it's why I have always loved Pampers, the number one pediatrician recommended brand. Download the Pampers Club app today to start earning rewards with every diapers and wipes purchase. Not to mention, get great parenting content with Pampers Club.
Hi, everybody. Juleika here with a confession. Like many of you, I've been drinking coffee since before I could walk. But lately, I've been happily sipping on herb teas from Tadin, a Latina-owned company based in Los Angeles for over 40 years. There's just something about their teas that takes me home emotionally. Like Tadin's Té de Manzanilla that calms my spirits. And the chamomile tea reminds me of my grandmother. And their lemon and ginger tea is perfect for that mid-afternoon work slump. Enjoy them hot or cold, or get creative with the easy recipes on Tadin's IG and website. That's tadin.com. Happy sipping!
Is there something that's getting in the way of your happiness or that's preventing you from achieving your goals? I have found that talking with someone can make a big difference, but sometimes the logistics, like finding the right person or the time to connect, make things complicated. BetterHelp Online Counseling connects you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. You can get help on your own time and at your own pace. You can schedule secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist.
BetterHelp's licensed professional counselors specialize in everything from depression to relationships to complicated family dynamics, self-esteem, grief, you get it. And if you're not happy with your counselor for any reason, you can request a new one at any time. They even have financial aid for those who qualify. Best of all, it's an affordable option. Latina to Latina listeners get 10% off your first month with the discount code Latina. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/Latina. Fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor. That's betterhelp.com/Latina. What were the first few months of that relationship like?
I mean, they were great. In retrospect, there were a lot of red flags. But at the time, I was like on cloud nine. I mean, I was so happy.
Because there's an early sort of plot twist, which is when you meet this woman, she has a girlfriend.
Yes.
She then tells you that she's in an open relationship with the girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of go through the whole rigmarole of imagining a future where it is the three of you.
Mm-hmm.
But then she comes to you and says, okay, I'm ready to be monogamous with you.
Yes.
Which must feel like being chosen.
That's exactly what it felt like.
Then there's bliss. And then when do things turn?
Well, looking back on it, things were turning the whole time.
Right.
I mean, even before that happened, even before we sort of went monogamous, I mean, I think there was this, she became a little less judicious about her anger, and she became a little less patient and a little more sort of quick to sort of snap and quick to bite. And there was this really early incident, very early on, in retrospect, like where she didn't know where I was, and she was really upset. And when she saw me again, she got like furious. And I remember her screaming at me so much. And I remember saying, like, being so scared and being like, don't do that. Like, don't talk to me like that. It's not okay how you're talking to me. This is like really bad. And I remember her like leaning over and being like, you can never write about this ever. Do you understand me? And I was like, yeah.
Ooh.
And that was like early, like that was like, it was a few months into the relationship. And I remember thinking like, that's a weird fluke, but it's just a fluke, you know? And I think, I mean,
when you spent years coming up with excuses for what were flukes and how you could explain things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every time something happened and every time it got worse, I would think to myself, like, there's gotta be a really logical explanation. Mm-hmm. So I remember like, I talk in the book about probably one of the worst and scariest part things, which was like two incidents that happened where she got very violent, like physically violent and really scary. And I like ran and like hid myself, like locked myself in the bathroom. And both times she claimed to have no memory. Like after it happened, she would say like, she would be like, why are you crying? I don't remember anything. Like what's wrong? And I remember like Googling like memory, like I was just like, well, there must be some explanation, you know? And I was looking up, I was like, could she be having some kind of like, you know, mental illness? Like, could something be really wrong? Could she have like hurt her head? Like, I was desperately scrabbling mm-hmm. to come up with some kind of explanation which would take the burden of responsibility off of her, like that it wasn't her bad behavior.
When did you finally identify and then verbalize those experiences as abuse?
It was after we broke up. I was on my way to this workshop in San Diego. So I was living in Iowa at the time, and there's this thing called Clarion. It's a science fiction and fantasy writers workshop in San Diego every summer, and it was the year that I was going to go. And so I drove from Iowa to San Diego, and on the way I stopped at various friends' houses along the way as I drove, and like a friend of mine, like telling her, I hadn't seen her in a while, and I sort of told her the whole story. And she like started talking to me, you know, people just were kind of giving me little bits of like kind of language or like ways to think about it. And she gave me like a book to look at. And then I talked to a couple of people about it. And then I remember one of them sent me this really beautiful essay by Connor Habib. He's this really beautiful writer. He's also an adult performer. And he had written this like devastating essay about a boyfriend who put him in the hospital. And I remember being like, I have just never read anything like this. And I don't know. And then, yeah, at some point in there, like, I think the word. And then when I started describing it, it was like, oh, I'm just describing an abusive relationship. Like, and it's like, I've walked other people through this. Like, I've had other people say to me, like, this is what happened to me. And being like, oh, that's like a very classic presentation. So I think, yeah, at some point I just got enough distance where I was like, you know, it was like in that summer where I just sort of really started thinking about it.
You write, I enter into the archive that domestic abuse between partners who share a gender identity is both possible and not uncommon, and that it can look something like this. Why do we assume safety in lesbian relationships?
I think because, and I say this as somebody who has dated both men and women, like I think dating men is like having a low-level cold all the time. There's always this sort of little bit of patriarchy that's like kind of dragging. And it's just the way it is, you know? It's like even if the guy is like great, you're still sort of negotiating like male bull. I probably can't swear.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, you're constantly negotiating male bullshit like all the time, right? And I think that there's something really lovely about like when you're in a relationship with a woman, like that particular dynamic, it's not like in your home, you know, like it's not like sort of in your bed. It's not in this. So there's this like distance you have from it. And a lot of the language that like surrounds like, you know, discussions of like queer women's relationships is like of like a utopia and a paradise where you're like, ah, here we are. We found it. It's great. Sex is great. The lesbian paradise, the lesbian utopia.
Did you have reservations about casting another queer woman as a villain in this story?
I mean, I think she cast herself as a villain. But yeah, I did have a lot of anxiety about it. I mean, I think if you ask any person who belongs to any sort of like
Marginalized group.
Yeah, marginalized group. Like, you know, it's really tricky to like, quote unquote, like air dirty laundry, you know, the idea of saying like, it's not perfect, it's not great, like, or I mean, it's great in a lot of ways, but also like, it can be bad. And like, this is how it can look. And
right. And you write beautifully about the fact that to complicate the experience is to actually acknowledge the humanity.
Yeah.
Right?
But yeah,
it's like there is a more, there's not a one-dimensional queer experience.
Totally. And I think, I mean, even now it's funny because people think like, oh, you guys got marriage, right? So like, you're great. And it's like, oh no, like, you know, I mean, right now the Supreme Court is like deciding stuff about, you know, queer people and trans people, like in terms of employment, like their ability to be fired. And like, we are all still not in a place of safety. And we're like, and it's hard because it's like, yeah, I talk about in the book how like you deserve rights because you deserve them because you're a human being, mm-hmm. not because you've proven yourself to be good or virtuous in some way. But I think there's a lot of stress and strain around like proving a certain kind of goodness or like you're worthy of the things that you're not being given by like dominant culture, or you're not being given by your government, or you're not being given by whatever. So like that to me was something that was like kind of like on my mind, you know, because all this was happening. The events of this book were happening around like the marriage equality conversation.
Right.
And like it was weird how that was kind of existed all around me while I'm afraid to say like I am being hurt in many ways by like this woman that I'm dating. So there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure to like perform virtue.
I just want to say, because this is such heavy topic area, such important topic area, there's a lot of levity in this book. Like, I feel like you sort of throw a lifeline to the reader to be like, I know that it was hard to live, it was hard to write, and so it must be a little hard to read.
I imagine it's very hard to read. People keep telling me that they read it in like in one sitting, and really?
Yes. Well, it's very suspenseful, and the way you play with form keeps it very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You said in another interview that writing in the dream house, quote, kind of killed a little part of you.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
I mean, the process of writing the book was very difficult. I was not in a good place writing it. It was really hard. And I think...
Wait, why?
Well, logistically speaking, I actually like went to a residency, so I was like away from my spouse, which was like really difficult. And I don't mind. I actually really love being like out in the wilderness writing, but it was really hard to do it. Like with fiction, it's like not a big deal. It's actually quite useful for me. But I just, you know, every day was just like pulling teeth, and at the end of the day, I would just be exhausted. And also, they were residencies that didn't have any like, you know, sometimes with the residency, you'll have like a social thing. Like it'll be like you'll have dinner with the other residents in the evening, but neither of the residencies I did had that. And so I would make dinner.
So
yeah, it was really isolated. And I would like make dinner and just be like thinking about the book as I was like cooking. And then I would like do the dishes. And then I would be like, well, I guess I'll just go back to my computer. So I would like make a drink, and then I would go like sit by my computer and just like stare at it. And then as I was writing it, I was like, this sucks.
Yeah.
Like this really not like the book, and the book is good. That's not, it's not even that. It's just like, this hurts. writing about this old self is like really painful and embarrassing. And like, I mourn for her. Like, I mourn for this person who isn't even around anymore, you know? She's just like stuck in this like eternal second person present tense, like just running on this hamster wheel of the past and like is just confused and is, you know, and I'm like pounding on the glass and trying to like say something to her. Like, it's gonna be fine. Like, you're gonna be okay. You're gonna be so happy. You don't even know. And I can't reach her. And I think acknowledging that and acknowledging like the things in me that have been shaped forever by this experience, which is just like the human condition. It's like things happen to you, you're different. That's just what it is. But there was something about like realizing like the ways in which like these weird little like ruts that she'd sort of carved in me and these like habits that she'd ingrained in me and like realizing that that was sort of permanent.
There's just such universality in specifics. Like, this is not my story, right? I did not live through this, but the experience of wanting to go back to a younger self and warn them or tell them something and knowing, and you say this in the Dreamhouse, the message is undeliverable. Right? Mm-hmm. There were other people who were telling you, Carmen, this is not a good relationship. Yeah. Carmen, this is toxic.
Yeah.
And they couldn't reach you. You couldn't have reached yourself.
Yeah. I talk in the book, you know, about the Nabokov self-consistency principle of time travel, this idea that, you know, even if time travel were possible, that like it would be impossible to go back in time and like change events that have already happened because like by definition they've happened. And so you can't do that. And I think that was like a metaphor that really stuck with me because I was like, yeah, like I can't undo it. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. And like, and that's really scary and sad, but also is it's just the way it is, you know?
Nabokov, which is a very hard thing to say with a New Jersey accent, thank you, is an excellent segue into the fact that a lot of playing with form here, a lot of first-person narrative, but also a lot of intellectual analysis and rigor around questions of love, villains, queerness. What did you want to achieve by doing that?
I think a kind of violence that people experience, people of all different sort of identities, is when you were told implicitly or explicitly that you are the only one or that your experience has no precedent and there's no place for it in the narrative. And so in this book, I was really interested in like taking pop culture and music and film. And like,
I mean, you've ruined a ton of Disney movies for me. Like, I now am going to look at all the villains and understand the ways in which they're playing on stereotype and trope.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I just wanted to sort of like say, like, let me try to like bend all this toward me and like show how I give myself the context that nobody else would give me. And that just became, really important.
You once in the book, if I read it as carefully as I think I read it, refer to yourself as ethnically ambiguous, but you never really refer to yourself as being Latina.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk to me about that choice.
Like, my relationship with my racial identity is complicated because I look white. I present as white. People assume that I'm white. I actually had this like very weird experience where somebody recognized me in a store in Philadelphia and then was like, I wasn't sure it was you because all white people look alike. And I wanted to correct them, but then I felt weird because this person was not. I was like, I don't know, you know, and like kind of just hemmed and hawed and then like just, you know, whatever. But like, so it's complicated because it's like I have a lot of privileges that come with like being white presenting.
Yeah, same.
But also like I'm not white and that's actually really important to me. Like, it's important to my identity and the way that I feel about myself and the way I feel about my family and the way I see myself. And I just sort of don't know like what to make of it, or I just haven't gotten to a place where I feel like comfortable writing about it more explicitly. But it is something that I'm thinking about very actively, and I've started many essays, which I have finished.
I personally hope you get to the place where you figure out what you want to say about it, because I want to read it and I want to see that placed in the canon.
Yeah.
You're now married.
Yes.
And there's a complicated element to this piece of the story, which is that when you meet the woman in the dream house, she's in an open relationship with a woman named Val.
Mm-hmm.
You are now married to Val.
Yes.
I had to read that about 10 times before my brain would fully compute that. Where do you place all of that in this story?
I mean, the way that Val and I sort of negotiate, I mean, it's complicated and it's not even a thing I really want to talk about like a ton, but, you know, I think a thing that I think a lot is like, if I could go back, you know, would I change it? Like, if I could, would I undo it? And it's like, no, I wouldn't, because it brought me this person. It brought me like the most important person in my whole life. And even though like there's a lot of trauma around this ex, our mutual ex, you know, neither of us would change it for anything. And that's hard. It's hard to say that, you know, and it's hard because I think, you know, writing this book, it's like writing about this really terrible thing that happened to me, but also like, I've also heard like Val talk about it. And like, it's weird because it's like externalized somehow, because it's like, it's different to hear somebody say like, here's a thing that happened to me, as opposed to like a thing that has happened to you personally. And it's almost makes me like angrier, you know, it almost like gives me even more feelings. And I think probably she has a similar reaction to reading this book. And so, you know, it's complicated, and but I wouldn't change it for anything. And I feel very lucky that, like, you know, this one really beautiful thing came out of this really horrible thing, and that feels very special and like a really rare gift that I don't know if I earned it, but I got it. So,
Carmen, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, as always, for joining us. Latina to Latina is executive produced and owned by Juleka Lantequa-Williams and me. Maria Muriel is our producer. Carolina Rodriguez is our sound engineer. Emma Forbes is our assistant producer. We love hearing from you, so email us at hola@latinatolatina.com. And remember to subscribe or follow us on Radio Public, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pandora, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. And please leave a review. It's one of the quickest ways to help us grow as a community.